So we go back to the same presentation, please, and bring us back to the place where we were. Yeah. Thank you. There is this great joke. He finds the place. Oh, here we are. So there will be no joke because we are at the place already. Okay. All right. So we were talking about the church and the externally focused church as the New Testament presents it to us. The fact is, most of our, at least German churches, I would say to 95%, are internally focused. I'm talking free churches. And you ask yourself a question now, why does Christianity lose in Western Europe? And the answer is, because the church is not a church. Oh, this is bad. It's bad news. Because the church is not pattern according to the New Testament. And Jesus, he builds his ecclesia. He is never going to build anything else. And the Bible tells us, if the master builder is not with us, then the builders are working in vain. And so working in vain is a huge problem. So we have to ask ourselves serious questions. And going from the internally focused paradigm to an externally focused paradigm is going to be the route to take. It's not easy. And it's not that simple as we may think. But I do not think there's any other way for us to recover the vibrance and the power of the church. And there is a powerful reality in the church. You can observe this in China today, or in India, or in other places of the world. Every single day, we see two new churches planted in Peru. You please go and look at those churches, and you are going to see churches which are built as a church for others. On the mission fields, we have always done things right. At home, in the Western so-called Christian world, we seem to be at a point where we believe it's not so important. We try to keep our traditional ways, and it doesn't work. So we were talking about the externally focused church as it is shaped. And now the question is, if we go to a context, sorry, we were not here, we were somewhere else. I will find a place. God's plan for the world, you're right, even go up, well, here we were. So if we say we have to join hands for missions, and we are there to take up responsibility for the world, so we have to be light for the world, we have to come up with a message of reconciliating God with the world. If we do so, then we have to have a theology of the world. John Howard Ziola, a North American free church theologian, once said, where there is no world, there will be no mission. It's a very simple sentence. But the simplicity of it is central. Where there is no world, understanding of the world, there will be no proper understanding of our mission. We automatically start to do our business. And our business will be a business of an internally focused church. And that's the problem. So if we want to know what God is planning with His church, we have to look into the God's plan for the world. And the big question is, how does God look at the world? Yeah? What is God's plan for the material? And what is God's plan for the social? And what is God's plan for the cognitive, the worldview? Is there something like a theological worldview for existing in the world? What is God's plan for the religious world? What is God's plan for culture? Does God have an alternative idea of a functioning culture, a functioning society? Does God have an idea of the world? So what's God's plan for the world? So if we look for a matrix We look for a place where the questions like that are answered. We find that answer in Isaiah 65, verse 19 and following. Now you may think about the passage whatever you want to. Some people say, well, this is a classic passage describing to us the 1,000 years of Christ's reign after he has come to the world. Regardless how you interpret this passage, the point in case is that Isaiah 65:19 and following describes to us a world under God's rule. So if you ask yourself a question, how would a world, how would a society look if God would have to say the same in that society? So then you go to Isaiah 65:19 following. Now, in order to understand Isaiah 65, you have to understand that the text is in the part of Isaiah which we call today the so-called Zion theology. Zion theology is a theology which heavily informed the theology of Jesus. When Jesus quotes Isaiah, he usually refers to texts coming out of that complex. We know Isaiah 53, for instance. Or we know Isaiah 61, when Jesus goes into the synagogue and he quotes Isaiah 61, verse 1 and 2, and he says, "The Spirit of God is upon me," Luke chapter 4, verse 18, and describes his own calling. He derives from the Zion theology, from the theology of Zion in Isaiah. So it is an important central piece of what God thinks is right. Isaiah 65:19 describes Jerusalem at a place where Jerusalem is going to be ruled by God only. And that time of God's rule in Jerusalem and in Israel in the Old Testament is called the Year of Jubilee. And the Year of Jubilee was the year in which Israel was not allowed to work, in which Israel was pushed to buy off all of their relatives who have somehow entered into slavery. It was the year where you had a huge distribution of wealth. People who have acquired wealth on the expense of their brothers and sisters, they would have to give it back. So everybody would turn back to the point of a new start. It was a great year, the year of Jubilee. Now when Jesus quotes Isaiah 61, verse 1 and 2, in Luke 14, verse 18 and following, he at the end says, he has been called to proclaim the Jubilee year. So his proclamation, his speech, his sermon, his good news is the good news which describes God's reign in the world. And God's reign in the world is described now to us in this great passage in Isaiah 65. And I do not have time to run through this with you, but I would like to encourage you tonight when you find time to sit down and read the passage, and you will be surprised how directly this passage addresses the material world, the social world, the cognitive and the religious. When the year of Jubilee comes, then nobody will still work with their own hands and not use that wealth worked out by themselves for themselves. They will build their houses and they will live in the houses. Nobody is going to die earlier than God wants them to die. Everybody will be healthy and live a whole span of life. Everybody is going to live a life according to her or his own calling. A material well-being. They will talk to each other. They will celebrate. There will be joy in the city. They will have social fellowship of an incredible size. And they will have in their places a system which runs Jerusalem and makes Jerusalem wealthy. Even the old destroyed places are going to be renewed. There will be a renewal, a socio-political renewal in the city. And then, God says, and then they will cry out and say, "Who are you?" And I will tell them, "Hello, here is me. I will be incredibly close to you." There will be a real relationship between God and man. So if you look for a matrix for a new world, you find that matrix in this particular text. And this particular text describes the year of Jubilee, and the year of Jubilee was Jesus' decision to proclaim the gospel of Jubilee. His preaching was preaching according to the ideas of God. So why do I tell you this? If that's the matrix, then that matrix is holistic. It is not a gospel which is only spiritual. It is a gospel which is material, social and cognitive and spiritual. So if that's what Jesus preached, and if that's what we have to preach, then we are going to find that the church can never do mission only in terms of proclamation alone. It's impossible. But that's what we evangelicals have believed for so long. The Lausanne movement, for instance, a huge worldwide movement, claims in the Lausanne Declaration, 1974, expresses verbis, the mission is proclamation, and social responsibility is given towards ethics and morals. No, mission is proclamation, but isn't mission also social responsibility? Isn't mission also to go and change nations towards disciples? Isn't that holistic? Isn't that much more than just clearly cut proclamative in nature only? So if churches start to understand that the new world which God wants to establish, His rule in the world He talks about is always holistic, then we will be helped enormously. So, the question is natürlich, sorry for natürlich, yeah. You will see, as soon as I start to get tired, you will hear German words and sometimes even other languages, but don't bother, I'm okay, I'm all okay, my brain is, computer is not functioning properly from time to time. So, if we look at the concept of bringing God's idea of a renewed world to the world, if we are ambassadors of reconciled world with God, if we are such ambassadors, and we want the world to understand that, then we will be responsible to look at the world as such. So where is the world now? Where is your city? Where is your village? Where are the people around you now? So in order to change the context, you have to do context analysis. Not knowing how the context functions. Now, what are you changing there? Yeah, I come to churches and I encourage churches to do context analysis. One of the books there is called Die Welt verstehen, to understand the world. And it is a book on context analysis. How does a church, it's a very practical book, it's not high theological and no high scientific, but it's a very practical book to help the church to enter a context and see what's really going on in your city, and what's really going on in your town, and how do people really feel in your town? Not what you presume they do. I'm very surprised to hear people telling me, "You know, Johannes, I live in that city now for 25 years. I know everybody here." Really? Do you really? Do you really, or do you pretend? Do you know what the people feel and how people are, or do you think you know? There is a world of a difference. And most of the people in the Western world always play. They play a game. You know, we are not a shame culture, but we operate like one. And if you are in Eastern Europe or you are in Southern, Southeastern Europe, if you live there and you work there, you be sure you live in a shame culture. That's even more problematic. The things they tell you in the obvious, they are obviously not things they really experience at home. You never, ever take the dirt out of your family and bring it to the street. You never do that. Sometimes funny, you know, knowing those cultures, I observe people how they behave. Never forget, here is an old couple. I follow a very old couple. I follow them, and they, you know, they holding hands and smile and leave the church. And so they went into the parking lot, and I was right behind them. They didn't see me. And then at one point, the old man said to his wife, "Now stop smiling. There's a bad German word. I don't even know to translate. Hör auf zu grinsen." How do you say that? Grin. You say grin? Oh, my goodness. See, I'm learning here. Yeah. Stop grinning. Stop smiling like this. And nobody observes any longer. And so you dropped her hand. And then I followed them, and I very soon found out the man was beating up his wife at home. But he was pretending in the church being a very holy one. Very holy one, smiling, always being nice and friendly, but only for the 2 hours of a service. So, you know, things you experience at home and things you show up with in the obvious, in public, are not always the same. To know what's going on in the public doesn't mean that you know what's going on in your city. So context analysis is important. So how does our world look like? Now, what does our world out there have? What do they have? How does the material world look like? And what do they have? What do they do? How are they socially doing? And what is the basic worldview driving their day? Especially in Eastern Europe, for those of us who come from there, you know, how do you behave in a society which is dropped into a ideological void? There was no ideology. There is none anymore. And now all of a sudden there comes a new ideology. You go to Ukraine. Ukraine is a funny country. Ukraine has a number of ports. You know, Ukraine and Black Sea? A number of ports, and they have no fishing industry anymore. Not a single fishing industrial complex anymore left. Why? They don't have even trawlers to go and fish. Why? Because the West helped them to get rid of it in order to make them buying the Western fish. Capitalism is never interested in the countries over there. Capitalism is always interested just in their own profit. Don't you think that Western capitalism is interested in developing those undeveloped countries? Not at all. They're interested in making profits on them. That's the nature of a society which is driven by a god of money. And a god of money has absolutely nothing to do with the Lord of Justice. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So in Ukraine, I was supervising some of their political parties, and one of them was appointed minister of fishing industry. It was interesting. I helped them to find money here in the West to buy the first couple of ships. And then he phoned me and he said, "Well, but how do we share?" Meaning, well, he is now a minister. He has to earn something. The minister, to earn something. So he's become capitalistic. If you are a minister, you have to earn something. Why would you buy ships from the West and do not get additional money? As simple as it is. It's capitalistic. So I told him, "Well, you will earn nothing, as I do, because we want your country to be promoted." I want your country. I want your people. I want your people in Nikolaev, and I want your people in your cities at the Black Sea. I want them to find jobs. I want them to earn money. I want your community raising. That's what I want to. And you want money for yourself. Well, he says, then I'm not interested. Well, sure, you are not interested because you have become capitalistic in your ways of thinking. And then what do they believe? What does the world believe out there? What do they believe? You go through Germany and you ask yourself, what do you young people at the age of maybe 16 to 18 believe today? And then you start to see for ways how to do your church. Because if you want to address them, you have to know where they are. You have to know where they are, what language they speak. And it's absolutely interesting. Now, my youngest daughter is turning 19 soon. And one day she comes to me and she says, Father, I'm not in. Everybody says I'm in. So I listened to her and said, well, daughter, we were always speaking English at home, and they speak a couple of other languages, my kids. So I listened to her and said, well, daughter, I don't know what you say. And she was very angry. And she says, well, even you do not understand me. I didn't understand her. I'm in. What's in? What is this? Well, she meant, they say I am in love. But how could I know that by saying I'm in? Yeah? Well, that's the way our young people talk today. They say, I'm Aldi. Well, they mean I'm going to Aldi. But I'm Aldi. It doesn't say anything to me yet. I'm in means I'm in love. But how do I know? I don't speak that kind of language. I'm not Turkish. I'm German. Yeah, I'm German. I know German quite well. I think I do. But she was very angry. So why are you not interested in my kind of language? But she's my daughter. She grew up in my house. How do I know how young people at the age of between 16 and 18 think if I do not even understand my own daughter? So context analysis becomes very important. And we ask ourselves those questions. What does our culture, our context have? What does our context do? And where is our context in terms of their worldview? And what do they believe? So if I answer those questions, then I have to take in consideration one more issue. So the world out there, the world out there is not a simple world. The world out there is a world which is run by people. Here, for instance, in this center of Europe. Sorry for not. I really didn't know. It was a revelation for me. Yeah. Now I'm so glad I'm in the center of Europe, and I think this very spot is it. Yeah. So. This very spot may be the center. So if the world out there, even in this little city, the center of Europe, is made by man, no question. But many, many things in this city are not made by man. Well, look out. There are trees, for instance. There are all kinds of plants. Man didn't make them. They exist because God planted them. They would not be there if God didn't plant them. It's His idea. So God is the shaper and the shaker of the city to a certain extent. Men are shapers and shakers of the city. But please, there's also a third dimension, and that's the devil. There are demonic powers. Our fight in the world is never against humans. Never ever. So there are demonic powers in the world. And those demonic powers, they are also shaping the context. So if I want to know what's going on in the context, I have to take up three perspectives. The book I'm referring to on context analysis does this. And at the end of such a process, the church is going to create a religious map, a social map of their city and their context. and a map of God's interference. So if I want to see God moving, I have to know where God is. Don't you tell me God is always only with the Nazarene. I hope so, He is with you. But He is obvious not only with them. God is out there. God is with every single tree out there. He is with every single piece of snow out there. God is the Creator. He is the Creator of the world. Nothing would function a day, even a second, without His presence. To say God is only with us is absolutely unbiblical. God is out there, and humans are there. And humans, by no definition, are humans only bad. Just imagine. I don't know how you feel, but do you like this seat, the chair? Okay, it's a good chair, right? Do you know who built them? Let's say Satanists here did it. Would you still like it? I have a computer here, a Dell computer, and it's obviously built in China. And that Dell computer built in China was probably produced by people who by no means were Christians. And I see your shirt here looks like made in India. Probably, maybe. And just imagine, those guys were Hindus. And they were absolutely unchristian. And the tie of your brother doesn't look nice. Well, I could continue like that. You see, as soon as we start to think, we all of a sudden discover that everything built by humans, we may enjoy it, and we don't even think about it, but it could be very demonic. Not the things they did, but the people who are behind it. Sometimes I fly. Well, I fly very often. My wife says my home is a plane. And she even rejected to celebrate with me our jubilee. We are married now for 32 years. And when we were married 25, it started with 25. She says, no, I will not celebrate it because you were just 12 years home. She didn't. She was right. She was absolutely right. So I'm sitting in that plane, and I the other day I flew the Airbus 380. I don't know whether you have ever taken that plane. It's a huge machine. It's an incredibly heavy thing. And I sat down and I enjoyed myself. I was a proud European. I thought of the Dreamliner of the Americans and I felt great. But we were just here. We Europeans. I was very happy. And my neighbor sitting beside me says, well, do you see the seats? I say, yes. So what's going with the seats? Well, I just had this information that the company doing the seats, they are heavily involved in a satanistic cult. You can't believe what happened to me. In the moment, I didn't feel well at all anymore. Like somebody was creating heat under my popo. My butt started to burn. I found it very difficult to sit there. And in the next moment, I started to imagine maybe the motors done by Rolls Royce, you know. Who knows who was there at work? And this whole 380 bad, big thing. You know, if that thing drops because God says, that is a really demonic creature. You laugh, but why in the world are we accepting the dress made by people who are not Christians, accept chairs made by non-Christians, enjoy our computers made by non-Christians, enjoy all the technological world, and most of it is done by non-Christians, enjoy all of this, have no clue and no inner protest. But as soon as we hear those people are non-Christians, we don't cooperate with them any longer. You see, the world out there is not just God-made, it's also human-made. And why? Because God has put into a human being an incredible creativity. He made us into His image. And even if we are the worst sinner, we still have something good in us. And you can see it. Two Satanists, terrible men who reject Jesus, they have sex with one another, and then a child is born. Tell me, who is the creator of that child? God is even there. He is present. He is even there in that moment with those human beings, blessing them and giving them a child and blessing them. God accepts humans as made in His image up to the last point of hope. He's a God of hope. The world out there is made by man, also made by man. And I don't know whether you enjoy it. So I started to think and debate with my neighbor, with myself, and with the Lord. And finally I said, well, Lord, if that chair is done by a Satanist, then I'll pray for him. He might find you. And in this moment, the heat was gone. My butt was feeling okay again. Because all of a sudden I discovered God's presence, even in the work of a person who might be totally wrong, but the person is still a person. Our fight, our struggle in the world is never against flesh and blood. Never ever. Ephesians chapter 6 verse 12. And if we start to fight humans, then we're lost. The world is God-made, theonomic, as we say in theology. The world is man-created, anthroponomic, as we say in theology. But the word is also demonic. Because the devil and his powers, demonic powers, they rule out there. They rule in the air. They are everywhere. They try to permeate cultures wherever they can. So if we look into the world, we will have to see the world tripolarly. And if we do not do so, then we play a blind game. We play a blind game. And many, many Christians play a blind game. They work for the Lord, but they never ask themselves, now Lord, where are you in the context? A great friend of mine, he experienced with his church in Romania, in Oradea, a revival. And one summer, he saw 600 people giving their life to Jesus. A Baptist church. It was a great experience. And then one day I visited him. We were supporting the churches in Romania with Bibles. And it was still the time of the Iron Curtain. And I'm a smuggler for the Lord. I enjoyed smuggling. Today it's difficult. You know, there's nothing to smuggle anymore. So sometimes I really enjoy going somewhere where I can do something illegal and say, well, Lord, there's no other way. Sorry for that. So for more than 10 years, we smuggled a lot of Bibles into those countries. And so I came to Romania and I visited my friend Paul Negrut. I said, Paul, tell me, now how comes so many people give their life to Jesus? In one summer, 600. And then he looked into my eyes and he says, Johannes, a very simple recipe. Paul was a doctor, a medical doctor. He never studied any theology. And might be his blessing. Because theologians are sometimes very complicated. And he says, well, it's a very simple recipe. You know what we do? We watch the Holy Spirit moving, and then we follow Him. Well, easy, right? But if I do not know where God is moving in my city, if I never ask myself that question, if I never did any context analysis, if I do not know where God is, now, do I follow Him? No, I follow my own theology. I follow my own ideas. And I create my own church. And that church is everything else but ecclesia. The church is only ecclesia if the Lord builds that ecclesia. The same thing with humans. If I know the humans, they have a cultural mandate. We humans, we're called to live in this world and to multiply and to rule in the world. And believers and non-believers, if he would have taken away the cultural mandate from non-believing people, there would be no kids anymore in those families. But there are still kids born. So the Lord didn't take away the cultural mandate from people living and staying in the world. Even if they are not following him, they're still there as humans. And that's why I have to ask myself a question. Now, where are those people operating in his interest? It's fascinating to see. If you look for social justice, you might find more communists doing exactly what the Lord wants us to do than Christians. Let me be very clear on that. If you look for ecological justice, for ecology, you might find among the Green Party people who are much closer to God's heart than some Christians are. So ask yourself, now where are people out there in the world? Where are they in terms of God's matrix, in terms of God's ideal world, in terms of God's idea? And you will find people who are fighting for justice, people who would do everything to see the world changed. And you know what? They are our allies. They are our allies. And I could feel now the basket with ideas we experience today in Germany. I stopped building churches for the people. I'm not Santa Claus. I stopped bringing the people always goodies and saying, well, enjoy it, blessing, it's for you. No. The people are not there waiting. They are not the underdogs. I come and I feed them. If I do so, if I play a Christian Santa Claus, at the end I will create people who are just sitting and waiting and expecting. Look at the Eastern Europe, what we did with the Eastern Europeans. And I am not saying somebody else has done it. During the opening of the former Soviet Union, we brought into Soviet Union more than 50, listen carefully, billion dollars in support. You could pave the streets of Moscow with 1 meter of New Testament books. And what did it do to the country? You know, you can't change the country with playing Santa Claus. You can't change people by playing Santa Claus. You come to the people and you do church with the people. You raise their consciousness. You show them who they are because God created them in His image. They've lost His image in many cases. They have been corrupted by sin. They have dropped ethical standards and moral standards. But they're still people. They're still humans. They are not apes. In the former Soviet Union, my teachers and my school teachers and university teachers, they worked hard to convince me that my cousins were apes. And they were talking about the jungle, the big jungle where we all came from. And then you saw what happens with the Soviet Union. They created their own jungle. The whole country became a jungle. So they were just driving into the jungle to their own cousins. But I'm sure if we would be able to ask those apes, those monkeys, hey, are you accepting communists as your cousins? They would tell you off. God never accept us. Because they are not our cousins. Not cousins of such stupid people. Not at all. The world is tripolar. And then there is Satan. You know what? We can never compromise with Satan. Never ever. You can never compromise with Satan. It's impossible. You can never come compromise with demonic powers. You can be quiet about them. Some people, church people say, don't talk too loud because, you know, the demons, they will hear it and then you are in trouble. Well, you're in trouble already. Yeah? The demonic powers are there because we are called to fight them. It's our battlefield. And knowing it, I will confront them. And if I do confront them, they will flee. That's what the Bible says very clearly. So our world is tripolar. Our world is tripolar. If we go and we want to build a church in the context, we can only build in the church in the context, understanding that context. That context is four leveled. That context is presuming material, social, and cognitive and religious culture. That context is God-built. It's tripolar. And in that context, there are powers which are real. And I am invited to come in to understand the context in order to formulate a message which derives its power from God's matrix of a new world. But then I go in and I want to change the world. How do I do this? In our evangelical circles, we created an interesting, funny idea. We somehow believe you want to evangelize people, then invite Billy Graham. Now, Billy is old, so invite Richard Graham. Or in Germany, we have Ulrich Pazani, my good friend. Or even Johannes Reimer. I have traveled the world intensively and evangelized in most of the parts of the world. And many people gave their life to Jesus. So you only invite a powerful evangelist. And then things are going to happen. We believed that. And we created actions, huge actions, very expensive actions. We paid huge sums of money for it. The results? They have become less and less and less convincing. I will never forget, here I am in a city in the Ural Mountains, and I preach the gospel, and we have 30,000 people listening in the stadium. And after I did the altar call, 15,000 came and signed up, gave their life to Jesus. A year back, I come to the same city, and we find nobody. It almost killed me. And after a third and fourth and fifth experience, I was deeply shocked. I was in charge for Billy Graham, the last Billy Graham crusade in Moscow, 1991. We had more than 30,000 people signing up that they have given their life to Jesus. A year after his crusade, we did an analysis of the Moscow churches, and we asked the church membership who has accepted Jesus in that crusade. You know how many we found? Not more than 10. Where the 30,000? Old Billy, he seems having felt the whole thing. Two times he canceled his engagement in Moscow. And then we did everything to convince him. Billy, you have to come. Russia expects you. Russia expects you. And then even we paid the Red Army Choir. They were half drunk singing those Christian songs. We paid them, they sang, and then America was enjoying it, and everybody, the whole world. See, even the Red Army Choir sings gospel songs. That was revolution. It was baloney. It wasn't revolution. And you see what happened at the end. Very little result. I do not want to say that there was no result, but big actions, lots of money went into actions in very, very, very little, spiritual fruit. You know why? Because it's not the Billy Grahams and the Johannes Reimers and all other evangelists who are called to be the agent of God's mission, but the church. It's the church. The missionary agent is the church. And that's why we have to ask for our own potential. We have to ask our churches, now what potential do we have? Not the Billy Grahams, not all those interdenominational agencies. We look there, you know, where's the big sponsor? People say, when we only have the sponsor. I say nothing starts with money. Absolutely nothing. Blessing doesn't start with money. Blessing doesn't even start on earth. Blessing starts in heaven. And there is no dollar in heaven and no euro. They don't need that thing there. They have so much gold that Jerusalem is going to be golden even on streets. They don't need any dollars and any euros. They operate absolutely different. So the question is, what is our missionary potential? Now, what we do in our churches, we work with the church and we ask the church for their potential on the material level. So I literally ask, how much do we have? People say, I have 2 cars. Write it down. I have 3 apartments. Or I have just 1 little room in my apartment, but I still could host a guest 2x a month. I have 20 hours. 3 hours. I could bring my hours in. So what material potential do you have? What gifts do you have? So we start to collect. I call it a gold mine of the church. Let's get this gold mine in front of our eyes presented. Now what do we have? As soon as I have all the information, and we do it personalized, so I have that person who promised, or who says, I have 2 cars that I'm ready for 3 times a month to give my car for church needs. As a pastor of the church, I'm not going to ask for a person who is volunteering to give me a car. I go to that Heinz. I say, Heinz, listen, you have written, you have for 3 times a month, you offer your car. Your car, please. I will not ask people if they offered their apartment for a guest. I will not ask in the church loud, who has an apartment? We have a guest. No, I will go to those who have volunteered. And we have it already. I have it all on my screen. So we know what the church has. Then the social gifts and social competence. What social competence does your church have? What social gifts does your church have? What cognitive gifts and competence does your church have? And what spiritual gifts does your church have? So bring it down means now you know the potential. And it's fascinating to see, as soon as you describe the light of God presented in your church members' lives, then you'll be able to go and light the darkest spots in the city. Because you know what you have. Never evangelize with foreign hands. Evangelize with your hands. Never evangelize with foreign money. Evangelize with your money. Never evangelize with foreign tongues. Evangelize with your own tongue. Never see foreign bodies doing your job you are supposed to do. Invest your own body. And then you'll be surprised what happens. God is going to add. He is going to add. And He does it big times. Big times. We just started a church, a new church, a small church, and we did an analysis of our city, so we know the context, we know the needs of the people in the city, and as a small church, we were 9 members, we asked the Lord what He wanted us to do, and He placed on our heart a vision to start a social center right in the middle of a city. It was a huge hotel, to buy the hotel, to restructure the hotel, and have in that hotel all those services people needed. For instance, we started a feeding scheme for about 150 people. We started an international cafe for about 30, 40 women coming there. Many of them Muslim. We started a open youth work in that center. And it has cost us already in the last 2.5 years, 500,000 euro. But we were 9 and now we are 39. And most of our people, young people, students, We didn't have the money. But you know who paid? The city did. People did. People, neighbors did. Because they, all of a sudden, they understood that is a needed thing. That's needed. We do this. So we invested what we've had. And God has added. And it's fascinating to see how He does it. It's great to see how He does it. People I would never expect, they would come and work and help us. A Muslim comes and he says, oh, what do you do here? We want to start feeding hungry people. Oh, he says, Allah is going to tell us to do the same. I say, well, then help. Really? Yeah. The next day he was there. Started to help. Then, of course, he comes and he wants to help and we didn't have enough materials, bricks or whatever we needed. And so we started to pray. And so the Muslim says, hey, are you also praying? Yes. And then he listened to us. And 2 hours later, somebody called. He said, fully unexpected, I have the stuff you need. Would you like to have it? But we don't have any money. It doesn't matter. I bring it this way. After the third such prayer request and the third such answer of God, that Muslim says, hey, Allah never does it to us. And then he had a problem. His mother got sick. And he comes and he says, would you pray for me or with me? Of course we prayed and God healed the mother. And then we prayed for another relative, and then we prayed for another relative. And the day came, and Ahmed came to me, and he says, hey, Johannes, I have a problem. Would you pray for me? He says, no, I won't. You can pray yourself. Well, Allah never listens to me. I say, well, you know why? He says, not really. I say, well, would you want to talk to me? I says, yes, I would like to. I say, well, you have a Quran? Yeah, bring it. And then I read the Quran to him. And it says, God never hears, listens to a prayer in the name of a sinner. Do you understand that? Yes, I do. Oh, I said, good. Then I said, read this surah. She reads the next place, the next surah, and says, Muhammad was the biggest of all sinners. He looks at me and says, so what? I say, well, okay, read that another surah. He reads, dead be to a person who says Isa has ever sinned. Isa, Jesus, the Messiah. See, I say, that's why I pray to in the name of Isa and you pray in the name of Muhammad. That's the problem. It's very simple. He says, but I'm a Muslim. How can I pray in the name of Isa? I say, well, because the Quran says. Hey, he says, that's clever. And then he prayed, and Isa answered. And then he came to me with big eyes and says, who is Isa? I want to know more about Isa. So then, of course, we started to talk Isa, and I said, well, read Quran. Read Quran. It says, if you have questions, you find no answer, you ask the people of the Injil, and that's the people of the New Testament. Say, right, now we have to read the Injil, because now we are at the point where you have to do exactly what the Quran says. Oh, he says, it's a good idea. So he started to read the New Testament. You can imagine, it didn't take long, maybe a year or so, and he was baptized. And there are many others. But why? Because I came to him and said, you Muslims are all bad. You Muslims are terrible. You Muslims are absolutely wrong. You Muslims are demonic. You follow a prophet who is absolute stupid. Did I say that? No. Not even close. I said, hey, let's do something together. Build a social center. Because your Muslims and all Christians and the non-Christians, they all need food. And I've never seen German bread becoming Muslim bread. I've never seen this. I've never seen German, normal German, black, wood bread, you know, rye bread or so, turning out Christian to be Christian. It doesn't taste Christian. It doesn't taste Muslim. It tastes bready. No more, no less. So let's do it together. And out of this, we started an incredible work changing his own world. So if we discover our potential, There is a book for the German speaking called Aufbruch in die Zukunft. In Russian it's called Adarion k Sluzheniu. And it talks about the spiritual gifts. And I believe that everybody, every church member has to do potential analysis. And the church is good, well doing to run with the members through such programs. And if you have such a potential analysis, then you start to involve them. So, where is the space to do mission? Space to do mission of God is very simple. See, here, if you have such a situation, you will have no evangelism, and the church will never grow. Why does this not function? So here we have the church in the middle of a culture, but with no connection with the culture. No connection with the culture. You do evangelism here, you have no success. But if you want to see success, then you have to change this. Then you have to find a place where your church, your Christian church culture, and the culture surrounding you overlap. You have to join hands with the world. Not in order to become worldlier, but in order to do in places where the world is open, God's work. And then all of a sudden, you know, the church takes over in big ways. And God blesses it because we do the right thing. I would like to conclude with a story of two pubs. You probably know the story already. Who knows the name of Alan Hirsch? Michael Frost, Alan Hirsch. If you read their book, yeah, Shaped in His Image, then you know the story. But not all do. That's why I tell you the story. And I could tell you many, many stories like that out of my own experience. But that story is so nice. The one story of a pub comes from Australia. So a Baptist church wanted to do mission outreach and in a certain area of the city. So they bought an old run-down pub. The pub was really run down. So they bought the pub, they restructured the pub, and it was became a very nice location. And in that location, they offered services. But nobody came. Absolutely nobody came. They invited the people, they ran around with trucks, they invited the people to come to the services, but nobody came. Before that, the pub was packed with people, but nobody came now. They created a little cafe, invite people to come for a tea and for a coffee, but nobody came. So at the end, they started to figure out, now, what is the problem? And an old man, everybody else was just saying nothing. If you have been to Australia, you know, they're very polite. They're very, 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 very polite. Yeah, they even say they mean die. And so it's very difficult to get information out of them. So they were not talking. And then old man said, well, you know, in earlier times, when we had that old rundown pub, we have a place where you could open your heart and just cry out tears and be you. Now we have a church. The second story comes out of Birmingham in England. And that's a great story. A great story. In Birmingham, there are many, many projects. One of the projects I describe in a little booklet called here, Church with Style. It's a Birmingham church with a second-hand shop, which became the platform for evangelism. Great experience. But this one church, in a run-down block of the city, a bad, bad situation. Yeah, they also bought that pub. But instead of changing the pub to a church, they left the pub in that pub. They just took the hard liquors away and added a couple of rooms for conversation, and then reopened the pub as a pub to the people. So people could come and have a beer and a Guinness and enjoy their time and talk to people. Opened the pub and brought a number of people, workers, into the pub to be available to those who wanted to or needed help and so on and so forth. And then they started a little agency offering jobs, small jobs, little earnings here and there. And then they opened a little counseling office for families who didn't make it any longer together, and they needed some family counseling. Everything in the pub. So the pub became a center of a social life for the whole place. Today, this Birmingham church is one of the largest in Birmingham. The pub is still there, but across the pub they have a huge hotel by now. They have a number of companies around this. They have offered many, many jobs to people. And if you ask people, now, which church do you belong to? They say, to the pub church. To the pub church. To the pub church. In our small village where we built a church, started about 11 years ago, we just bought an old swimming pool. And instead of recreating that swimming pool into a church, we started to rebuild and restructure the showers for soccer players and invited the whole city to come and help us. We were 14 members. When we were done with our center, we were 212. People came and they structured together with us. They worked together with us. And today they worship together with us. But in order to do so, we had to go that way. We had to, in the material world, to minister to them. What happened? Trust developed. The basic issue in evangelism and church planting is trust. If there is no trust, you can't reach nothing. You will reach nothing. So we ministered to them, with them, to the people around, and trust was established. Then if you start to trust people, you will automatically talk. There is no other way. You have a problem with your wife? You find that man without a problem with his own wife? Even if they are pious? I'm married for 32 years to a wife. I love her dearly. I love my wife. She's the greatest woman in the whole universe. But don't ask me whether I understand her fully. I do not. I'm glad I'm just one of them. I would never be able to take two. I'm enough with one. I'm glad with one. So men will always find a way and a need to talk to each other about, you know, that creature called wife. And for the women, I mean, I know my wife sometimes looks into my eyes and says, "Are you never growing up?" It's funny. I'm grown up. I'm 58. Ma'am, I'm 58. So we always find ways to discuss. As soon as trust is established, we start talking. It's automatic. You don't have to look for opportunities. They will come automatically. And then you talk. You talk about life. You do not just talk on the level of spirituality, which is five stories higher than yourself. We discuss life together, and what happens? More trust is building up. And then we enter a social level where conversation becomes normal, a dialogue is normal. And then you move to the next level, to the level of cognitive culture. And in cognitive issues, you start to discourse, you debate, you fight, you want to know the truth. But because there is enough trust, you will not reject conversation. You will debate. And after that debate, you start evangelize. And I tell you, people will naturally become Christians. And then the Western world is going to see people giving their life to Jesus. And this is already reality in many places. But now I have overdone my time. You were very, very patient with me. Thank you very much. Amen.